Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Manned space flights into deep space are on the horizon. We've been hearing in our news all that talk about Mars being the next destination for humans, for instance. But will future space travelers, who will be years on their journeys in some cases, be able to munch a nice, crispy salad or bite into a fresh apple? Well, my guest is a graduate student who's on a team tackling the challenges of growing plants in space. Theron Young is a graduate student in mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. He's been awarded a one-year fellowship with the Iowa Space Consortium and is part of a team studying ways on how best to grow and study plants in deep space. He joins us from our Ames studio. Theron Young, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So tell us about your project, your team, your goals, why this is needed.
Why this is needed? That's a very good question. So we know that the world population is increasing. By the year 2050, we're expected to reach about 9 billion people. So the challenge is, how do we grow more food for these people? And the answer to that is we have to grow more food, but how do we increase yield? How do we improve the methods that the farmers use to go out in the field and phenotype the crops?
Mm-hmm. Phenotype meaning what?
Measure the physical traits of a plant.
Okay, so the color of it, the height, the leaf formation, and so forth.
Exactly. Color, height, the width of the leaf, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is a one-year fellowship with the Iowa Space Consortium, but it also has something to do with space travel, not just making perhaps crops for us to consume here on Earth, but also for space travelers?
Exactly. So eventually we're going to go to Mars. We know that now. But a challenge is how do we nourish the astronauts while they're in travel?
Mm-hmm.
To do that, we're going to have to grow plants in deep space. Right now, some of the challenges that we have is one of them being there's a lot of radiation in space.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes it difficult to grow plants and also difficult for astronauts to travel that far. That's really the biggest challenge or the biggest obstacle that we have as far as why we haven't been able to go out that far right now.
Right, and I've talked with Peggy Houston of the International Space Station, and when they are there, it's little known or perhaps not known by everyone that you're bombarded by dangerous radiation all the time. And this is dangerous not only to humans, but all life forms.
Exactly. So in space, you have three types of radiation or three types of ionizing radiation. Here on Earth, we have the X-rays, we have the gamma rays. But in space, you have ionizing radiation. This can include galactic cosmic particles, several others. And the reason that this type of radiation is dangerous is because it travels faster than the radiation that we encounter here on Earth. And because it travels faster, when it makes contact with the cells in your body, it can tear those cells apart. And you can have symptoms such as cancer, cataracts, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so radiation exposure is one challenge that has to be met to grow things in space. What else? I mean, obviously we have weightlessness, zero gravity. Is that a challenge? I think I saw in a recent news release that the International Space Station is doing a little bit of an experiment growing identical seedlings on Earth during a month-long experiment to compare their growth on Earth with gravity and then without gravity on the space station.
Exactly. And these types of experiments have been going on since the 1970s when astronauts first started putting plant growth stations in space. And they're doing this because on Earth, seeds know to grow their shoots upward because mm-hmm. of gravity. They can sense gravity. Seeds can sense the gravity. But when we get into space, We don't have that gravity anymore. And when we're talking about planets such as Mars, you have reduced gravity. It's not zero gravity, but there's a significant reduction in gravity as compared to Earth. Mm-hmm. So in space, the seeds don't know which way to grow. So you're going to have some plants that might grow shorter in space than they would grow on Earth.
So what happens if you have that? What do you think will happen in this experiment? If you give everything else a plant everything else it needs to grow, the light, protect it from the radiation, you put it up in space, you put it in a little astral pot so that the soil, the dirt doesn't fly all over your space station. You give it water. How's that plant going to be looking differently after some growth, not knowing, well, having no gravity to sense?
Well, in the worst-case scenario, the plant won't develop properly. So it's not going to develop the fruit that it's supposed to yield.
Mm-hmm. So it just thinks something's wrong here, and I'm not going to be fruitful and multiply.
Right. And so this also is connected to how the water is transported through the plant.
Mm.
Because there isn't any gravity to direct water flow, and we're not using regular photosynthesis here, so we don't have the sunlight to interact with the plant as it does on Earth. So there's going to be sort of alterations as to how nutrients and water flow through the plant because of that absence of gravity.
Okay, so how do you correct for that? How do you get plants? Because unless you can, I guess, use CRISPR to change the DNA, I don't know if there's a zero-gravity plant or zero-gravity DNA out there, but I assume you have to create some sort of artificial gravity?
Exactly.
Okay, so that's another challenge here. Specifically to your work, Theron, what is your part? Because you're part of a larger team here.
Yes, so I'm part of a larger team, and I'm working more on the computer vision side of the project.
Mm-hmm.
So in my group, we're using computer vision to create these high-throughput methods of phenotyping or measuring plants. So for an example, if I had a plant that produced a flower that was a certain color, let's say red,
mm-hmm.
And the farmer's objective or the plant scientist's objective was to go out and to see how many of these plants have bloomed or blossomed to a certain maturity level that would let them know or let them predict when it's okay to go out and harvest the plant. What I would do as an engineer working with computer vision is create an application that can automatically detect the color of that flower so that the farmer or the plant scientist doesn't have to go out there and do that, because typically the plant scientists, the farmers, they don't want to be out there making those measurements. One, it takes a lot of time. Two, because a human is doing it, is prone to human error. So if we had systems out in the field that captured those pictures for us, and then we created computer applications that go in and look at these images and detect the colors and show us what's blooming and what's not blooming, then that takes that saves a lot of time for the farmers, and it also creates a process that's more efficient and more robust than, say, someone going out and looking at these plants by eye and saying, okay, this is bloomed, this hasn't bloomed.
So it sounds like to any farmers listening here in Iowa, you're kind of eliminating farmers in space from our future. Because robots will be doing it, huh?
Well, not completely, but it definitely would be an improvement. It's something that we could use to increase production and yield in plants.
So with your imaging, what are you encountering specifically, the challenges, the biggest hurdles that you're facing, Theron?
One of the biggest hurdles that I face is that lighting. So when we're growing plants in a greenhouse or out in the field, the position of the sun changes. So we might capture some images when the sun is directly above us, say at noon, and we might capture other images in the morning where the sun is just beginning to rise. And that position of the sun is going to change the light intensity of our images. So if we create an algorithm that can go in and find a specific color of a plant that, say, was captured at 12 o'clock, that color of the plant is going to be different from a picture of a plant that was captured that morning. So mm-hmm. we have to sort of make adjustments or create adjustments or look out for those types of challenges when we're considering these processes.
Right. Is there another way to ascertain ripeness besides visually? I mean, we look at a peach to see if it's the right color, but really, if I want to know if a peach is ripe, I want to touch it, right?
Exactly. So there are other ways. There are some people in my group that are working with hydrospectral imaging. So these are wavelengths that we can't see with our eye. So these are wavelengths that are outside the visual band of wavelengths that we're used to seeing, like color like red, white, blue. So they're using these hyperspectral cameras to detect colors or wavelengths that our eyes can't see. And these wavelengths tell us something about the health of the plant. So these are things that are occurring before we can actually physically see it.
Mm. If you've just joined us, Theron Young is my guest this half hour, graduate student in mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. He's been awarded a one-year fellowship with the Iowa Space Consortium. Fascinating research being done here. Part of a team studying ways on how best to grow and study plants in deep space. Now, this is the start of your fellowship, I understand. You're at the front end of this, right, Theron?
Yes, just began this semester.
Mm-hmm. So you've been reaching out, your team has been reaching out to NASA, to experts there, right?
We haven't reached out personally, but we've definitely been looking at certain people that work on these types of things. And I think in some conversations, we've been talking about having them to come to Iowa State and so that we can have a discussion, sort of a small conference to see, you know, what they think and if they can offer any type of guidance for our projects.
Mm-hmm. Another challenge I see is well, it's cramped quarters up there for humans or for plants. So how big of a challenge is this to get past here? Because, of course, we have vast fields of corn and soybeans here in Iowa, but that vastness is not necessarily up there for space because we can't create all that environment, right?
Right. And I don't think the overall objective of space agriculture is to replace what we already have, but it's definitely something that can come in and assist our current farming methods.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, one challenge we do have is space constraints. So when we're on board something like the International Space Station, there's a limited amount of space that can be allotted for growing plants or doing plant experiments. So when we go to agronomists or people in plant science, we're looking for plants that are suitable for these types of environments. So we're thinking in terms of dwarfs or plants that can be genetically modified to grow smaller or produce less biomass.
Mm-hmm. How did you get interested in this, Theron? What path led you here? Did you think you would be doing this, say, 5 years ago?
Never. Never at all. So actually, I was working on another project, collaborating with some people in civil engineering. We were developing this this isophobic coating that can be sprayed on airport pavements to reduce ice adhesion. This is something that's applicable for airports that are in this area that experience a lot of snow, and this causes a lot of flight delays and such. So at the end of this project, my lab happened to have access to a stereo microscope that could be used to look at trichomes. So trichomes are the little hairs that we see on plants or on plant leaves.
Mm.
So because we had this microscope, one of the professors in agronomy, her name is Dr. Artie Singh, she wanted me to look at trichomes on a soybean plant. And so I developed this process where I can strip the chlorophyll from the leaf or the green pigment from the leaf to make it translucent and then put the leaf under the microscope and take images of the trichomes. And I liked this project a lot because it was something that was way out there, and I saw the applications that it had for space agriculture, which was something that I was also interested in. So after that project, I decided after my master's to consider continue working on this project, and here I am now.
Right, right. And computers are a big part of your work. So how do they fit in? What type of, do you program things or are you in a different level there?
Right. So there's a lot of programming and computer vision is just a sort of a subset of computer science where we're manipulating images and we're sort of teaching a computer to see an image the way that we see it. So if I show you a picture of an apple, you can tell me that it's an apple. And you can tell me that it's an apple because of the way it's shaped or the color that it is. But when we give that image to a computer, it sees it differently. So a computer is basically seeing numbers or matrices. And these matrices contain information about the color and the shape size of the image. So for the color red, a computer sees this in RGB. So this RGB color space is basically red, green, and blue. And for the color red, we can say that value is 200. So when a computer sees red, it sees 200. So we want to tell the computer to see that specific number.
So I don't say, computer, I don't want a tomato until it's 200, right?
Right. That's not the exact number, but that's basically what
we're
doing.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
So when we talk about what the imaging area that you work in or other technology we're needing, what can you see as advances in technology that need to come to, that will be most important to achieving plant growth, phenotyping, I think you said, and deep space missions?
Right. As far as deep space missions, I think we definitely need materials that can withstand more radiation. So radiation shielding materials. From the literature that I've read, hydrogen is a material that was sort of the best material as far as reflecting radiation because it has a low atomic number. So you're basically looking for materials that have a low atomic number, and hydrogen is like one. So I've seen concept drawings and read papers where they're trying to create these spacecraft that have a shield of water or hydrogen on the outside that basically absorbs more radiation so that it doesn't get into the aircraft. So advances like that, I think, are something that we should be looking more into. And a lot of people are looking into that.
Mm-hmm. Are you a fan of science fiction at all?
Sure, I am.
Does that inform your work? I mean, do you see films, space films out there that inform your work and you say, based on what I know, that's what it's going to be like, or that is not at all what it's going to be like?
Well, one that I can speak on, and I'm sure everyone else can speak on, is The Martian.
Yes.
That was a great book and also a great movie.
Mm-hmm. And he was growing plants. He built a little structure on Mars and was going to feed himself until he could be rescued, right?
Right, and I went to a space agriculture conference about a year ago, and they basically tore the movie apart because of all of the things that were depicted that could never happen in real life.
Oh, really? I thought he had written it online, and he had received so much feedback from agronomists and so forth that he had kind of tweaked it so that it was more or less a workable scenario, but you say not, huh?
Some of it was workable, but there are some parts in the movie where, you know, some people would sort of shake their heads and say, okay, that's maybe a little bit exaggerated for the movie, but.
Mm-hmm. So this has applications too. You mentioned Mars, our next perhaps destination for humans. Plenty of probes have been to Mars. The moon, when you're awarded the Iowa Space Consortium by the Space Consortium, this fellowship, what are the possible other applications that we haven't discussed yet or are out there?
Other applications, one big application could be this area called bioregenerative life support systems. So if we think of a rainforest, a rainforest basically creates its own weather because of all of the vegetation and all of the moisture that it gets. The sun basically evaporates the water, it goes up, forms clouds, and it rains on it again. So it has its own, sort of its own weather, it's isolated from the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of want that same type of technology on board the spacecraft. So when we begin building these plant growth stations on different planets. We want systems that can basically support themselves, so they can recycle the water that they use. They can recycle the carbon dioxide.
Do you have any idea how many years out this is conceivable? Any guesses? I know you've got a very small sliver of the pie that you're researching important work, but there's a bigger picture, I realize. And any guesses?
It's difficult to put a number on it, but I want to say not in my lifetime.
Not in, and you're a young man.
I know, and that's kind of I guess that's kind of putting it out there, but when you think of our current growing practices, you know, you see these big fields with corn and soybean and wheat, and just thinking about, you know, having that same type of impact on another planet when the climate on other planets are totally different. I mean, when you think about Mars, the average temperature in the summer can get up to about 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but then at night it can plummet to as low as negative 100 degrees Fahrenheit.
So you need more than garbage bags and duct tape.
Right. So the way I see it is definitely going to be something that's artificial, something that's using artificial lighting that's in a closed environment if we're talking about another planet.
I wonder if you could imagine yourself, Theron, you couldn't imagine yourself doing what you're doing now 5 years ago, but maybe in another 5 years you'll be on your way in some form to working in space. Would that be something for you?
That's something. There's really something to think about. But I never know. And so far on this journey, graduate school journey, opportunities just pop up, and you never know what you're gonna get, what situation you're gonna get put into, or what type of research you're gonna be doing. But I definitely could see that.
Okay, very good. Well, it's been wonderful talking with you about your fascinating research. Theron Young, graduate student in mechanical engineering at Iowa State University, awarded a one-year fellowship. He's just started it with the Iowa Space Consortium, a part of a team studying ways to best grow and study plants in deep space. Fascinating research. You're a lucky man to be doing it, Theron. Perhaps we'll check back in the future and see how your lettuce and your veggies are growing. No, I know. You're just doing imaging there, too. But maybe we'll check back in. Theron, thanks for coming into our studio.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Coming back, when we come back after a short break, I'll talk with acclaimed historian Carol Anderson. She has an award-winning book out recently in 2016, won multiple awards. It's called White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. In the book, she chronicles the powerful forces opposed to black progress in America. She'll comment on her message in that book. It's not about the Klan. It's not about neo-Nazis. It's about institutional racism, is what she says. I'll also ask her what she thinks of that idea of Oprah for president. That's when we return. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.